my dear V. Oh, these daughters. My dear Veronica, your aunt tells me you have involved yourself in some arrangement with the Widget girls about a fancy dress ball in London. I gather you wish to go up in some fantastic get-up, wrapped about in your opera cloak, and that after the festivities, you propose to stay with these friends of yours at an hotel in Soho. Now, I'm sorry, but I regret to say... No. You have begun to get hold of some very queer ideas about what a young lady in your position
may... About what a young lady in your position may or may not venture to do. And as a result, you are restless, aggressive, and critical. The life of a young girl is set about with prowling pitfalls from which you must be shielded at all costs. So long as I am your father, so long as your life is entrusted to my care, I feel bound to use my authority to check this disposition of yours towards extravagant enterprises. A day will come when you will thank me, so do please believe that in this matter I am acting for the best. He couldn't even tell me to my face. He had to do it by letter.
A Wednesday afternoon in late September 1908, and Anne Veronica Stanley is on a train back to Morningside Park in a state of solemn excitement.
My mind is made up.
She's quite resolved to have things out with her father that very evening.
It is a crisis, but it must be a decisive crisis.
Anne Veronica had a compartment to herself in the train from London, and she sat with both her feet on the seat, in an attitude that would certainly have distressed her mother to see and horrified her grandmother beyond measure, with her knees up to her chin and her hands clasped before them. And she was so lost in thought that...
Lord, you idiot, Anne Veronica, we're here!
Morningside Park was a suburb that had not altogether, as they say, come off.
Ye gods, just look at the place.
Like pre-Roman Gaul, it consisted of three parts. The avenue, with its big yellow brick villas curved elegantly from the railway station, and under the railway arch was a congestion of workmen's dwellings.
It's now or never. Much as I hate rows, I've either got to make a stand or give in altogether.
She walked down the station approach that led to the field path home. Outside the post office stood a blonde young man in grey flannels who was elaborately fixing a stamp to a letter.
Oh, here goes. Hello, V.
Oh, hello, Teddy.
But it was clear she was in no mood for Teddy's.
Oh.
He became rigid.
Damn it.
And a singularly bright shade of pink.
Damn it.
Anne Veronica Stanley was 21 and a half years old. She had black hair, fine eyebrows, and a clear complexion. And the forces that had modelled her features had loved and lingered at their work and made them subtle and fine. She was a clever girl, the best in her year, with an aptitude and an enthusiasm for science and a particular skill in dissection. Her manner was one of quiet reserve, but behind the mask, she was wildly discontented and eager for freedom and life.
I want to live, to do, to be, to experience. There is no place for me in this world, no place and nothing.
Molly!
Yes?
Did V get my letter?
Yes, the maid gave it to her after you left, as you instructed.
You read it, didn't you? What do you think of it?
Yes, I thought it was firm and affectionate.
I could have said more.
You seem to have said just what had to be said. She really must not go to that affair. I don't think she quite sees the harm of those Widget people or the sort of life to which they could draw her. They would spoil her every chance.
She has chances.
Well, she's an extremely attractive girl. Of course, one doesn't want to talk about things until there are things to talk about.
All the more reason why she shouldn't get herself talked about.
Anne Veronica's resolve to have things out with her father was not accomplished without difficulty. Mr. Stanley had dinner in his room and was not to be disturbed.
Father?
Go away, V. I'm busy.
It's important, Father, that I speak to you.
It's impossible tonight. I'm too busy.
Anne Veronica was Peter Stanley's youngest child. Her mother had died when she was 13. Her two elder sisters were married off. Her two brothers had gone out into the world well ahead of her, so she had made what she could of her father, but he was not a father one could make much of. He was a solicitor with a good deal of company business, a lean, worried-looking, clean-shaven man of 63. His ideas about girls and women were of a sentimental and modest quality. He had no idea about daughters.
Daughters? I never really wanted daughters. They happen to a man. Of course, a little daughter is a delightful thing. It runs about gaily and romps, bright and pretty, makes up wonderful sentences you can repeat in the city, and are good enough for Punch. You call it a lot of nicknames, Babs and Bis and Viddles and V. It loves to sit on your knee. All that is jolly and as it should be. But a little daughter is one thing, and a daughter is another. And now, here's Ann Veronica, my little V, going about with hatless friends to socialist meetings and art class dances, taking her scientific ambitions to unwomanly lengths. She seems to think I'm merely the paymaster. And now she wants to leave Treadgold College and go to the Imperial College London and study and have science classes and fancy dress dances in a pirate costume and stay the night in some ramshackle hotel in Soho.
Breakfast was also an impossible occasion for Ann Veronica. Mr. Stanley read the Times with an unusually passionate interest and then declared suddenly he was getting an earlier train.
I'm getting an earlier train this morning.
Father, I...
Goodbye!
Father! Father! I'll come to the station with you. I may as well come up by that train.
I may have to run.
I'll run too.
Instead of which, they walked sharply.
I say, Daddy...
If it's about that dance project, it's no good. I've made up my mind.
You made me look a fool before all my friends.
You shouldn't have made an engagement until you consulted your aunt.
I thought I was old enough.
I won't have you quarrelling and crying in the avenue. Stop it! Got anything to say, you must say it to your aunt.
But look here, Daddy.
It's settled. You're not to go.
But it's about other things, too.
I don't care. This isn't the place. Look, there's Ramage ahead of us. We don't want him overhearing you.
May I come to the study tonight, after dinner?
I'm busy.
It's important. I do want to come to an understanding between us.
No right to badger me like this, Veronica.
Tonight, then, Daddy.
Morning, Stanley.
Morning, Ramage.
Ramage saluted elaborately. He was the occupant of the big house at the end of the avenue. He was an outside broker and the proprietor of a financial newspaper. He had come up very rapidly in the last few years. He did not play golf, but took his exercise on horseback. Mr. Stanley liked and detested him in almost equal measure.
Is Miss Stanley coming up with us?
I go second class and change at Wimbledon.
We'll all go second class, if we may.
How's Mrs. Ramage?
Oh, very much as usual. She finds lying up so very irksome, but you see, she has to lie up all the time with her state of health.
His lovemaking struck me as unconvincing. He seemed too noisy.
Mr. Stanley was on the verge of convulsion at his daughter's observations. He was pretending to read the Times as Ann Veronica and Ramage were discussing one of those advanced modern plays. Luckily, Ramage turned the conversation around.
You see, Roddick is a heavy man, but the main interest of the play is the embezzlement.
They reached Wimbledon.
Thank heaven for that.
And Ramage whipped out his hand to help Miss Stanley onto the platform.
There you are, my dear.
As though she had been a duchess, and she descended as though such attentions from middle-aged merchants were a matter of course.
Well... These young people grow up so fast, Stanley. Seems only yesterday that she was running down the avenue all hair and legs.
Now she's all hats and ideas.
At the end of dinner that evening, Ann Veronica began.
Father!
If there is anything you wish to say to me, you must say it in the study. I'm going to smoke a little here, and then I shall go there. I don't see what you can have to say. I should have thought my note cleared up everything. There are some papers I have to look through tonight. Important papers.
I won't keep you very long, Daddy.
I will leave you in peace.
Molly, I don't see why you and V shouldn't discuss this little affair or whatever it is without bothering me.
I need to speak to you, Father, and I will come to your study later.
The air was thick with feelings. Her aunt went out of the room with dignity and a rustle.
Sit down.
Thank you, I'd rather stand.
When Ann Veronica came into the study later, her father held some printed document in his hand and appeared not to see her.
And what is this all about, Veronica?
Look here, Daddy. I must go to that dance, you know.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, because I really don't see why I shouldn't.
Ah, but you see, I do.
And I have promised Constance Widget that I would.
Without asking my permission?
Why shouldn't I go?
It isn't a suitable place, it isn't a suitable gathering.
But, Daddy, what do you know of the place and the gathering?
And it's entirely out of order. The idea is preposterous.
You see, I don't think it is preposterous. That's what I really wanted to discuss.
Ah.
It comes to this. Am I to be trusted to take care of myself, or am I not?
To judge from this proposal of yours, I should say not.
I think I am.
As long as you remain under my roof...
You're going to treat me as though I wasn't. Well, I don't think that's fair.
My dear girl, you're a mere child. You know nothing of life, nothing of its dangers, nothing of its possibilities. You think everything is harmless and simple and so forth. It isn't. There it is, you can't go.
You say I know nothing. That's probably true.
Mm.
But how am I to get to know of things?
Some things I hope you may never know.
I want to be a human being. I want to learn and know about things and not be protected as something too precious for life. Cooped up in some little corner.
Cooped up? Did I stand in the way of you going to college? Have I ever prevented you going about at a reasonable hour? You've got a bicycle.
I want to be taken seriously. Oh. A girl at my age is grown up. You talk of college. I don't want to go to the local college. I want to go to Imperial College London and work under proper conditions. Now that I've done the intermediate, it's not as if I haven't done well. I've never muffed an exam yet. My big brother Roddy muffed too.
There are plenty of things a girl can find to do at home.
Until someone takes pity on me and marries me.
Oh, we've spoken of this before, and anyway, you're changing the subject now.
You started it. Look here, Father. Suppose I won't stand it. Suppose, for example, I go to this dance.
You won't. I have forbidden it.
Yes, I know, but suppose I go.
Now, Veronica, no. No.
Both faces were flushed and obstinate. She was trying by some wonderful and secret motionless gymnastics to restrain her tears.
You won't let me live, and you won't let me exist.
What nonsense. My dear child, you do live. You do exist. You have this home, you have friends, acquaintances, social standing, every advantage. Instead, though, you want to cut up rabbits at university. Dance about at nights in wild costumes with art students and God knows who. That isn't living. You must not. You shall not go.
Well, good night, Father.
What? What? Not a kiss.
Are you coming to the Fadden dance, Ann Veronica?
Yes, Constance, I mean to.
Are you making your dress?
Such as it is.
They were in Constance Widget's bedroom. Mr. Widget, her father, was a journalist and critic. He travelled third class to London by unusual trains and openly despised golf. The girls went to the Fadden Art School and led a bright, eventful life of art student dances, socialist meetings, theatre galleries, talking about work and even, at intervals, working. On Constance's bed, there was seated a slender lady of 30 or so in a dingy green dress, whom Constance had introduced as Miss Miniver. On her lapel was an ivory button bearing the words, Votes for Women. Ann Veronica sat at the foot of the bed while Teddy Widget occupied the only bedroom chair, smoked cigarettes, and tried to conceal the fact that he was looking all the time at Ann Veronica's eyebrows.
I've been forbidden to come to the ball.
My God!
Auntie Molly.
No, my father. It's a serious prohibition.
Why?
That's just the point. I asked him why, and he hadn't got a reason.
You asked your father for a reason?
Yes, Miss Miniver. I tried to have it out with him, but he wouldn't have it. Well, that's why I think I ought to come.
We always have it out with our father, poor dear. He's almost got to like it.
Men never have a reason. Never. And they don't know it. It's one of their very worst traits.
But I say, V, if you're forbidden to come and you do come, there'll be the deuce of a row.
There's the whole situation. Apparently, I'm not to exist yet. I'm not to study, I'm not to grow. I've got to stay at home and remain in a state of suspended animation.
Dusting?
Yes.
Until you marry, V.
Well, thousands of women have married merely for freedom. and found it a worse slavery.
I suppose it's our lot, but it's very beastly. Slavery. Downtroddenness. When I think of it, I feel all over boot marks.
Well, as things are at present, it is true. We live under man-made institutions, and that is what they amount to. Every girl in the world, practically, except a few of us who teach or typewrite, and then we're underpaid and sweated. Mm. It's dreadful to think how we are sweated.
Yes.
Until we have the vote, that is how things will be.
I'm all for the vote.
I suppose a girl must be underpaid and sweated. There's no way of getting a decent income independently.
Women have practically no economic freedom because they have no political freedom. The one decent profession, for a woman, except the stage, is teaching. And there we trample on each other. Everywhere else, the law, prejudice, bars us.
There's art and writing, Miss Miniver.
Everyone hasn't the gift. Even there, a woman never gets a fair chance. Men are against her. Whatever she does is minimised. All the best novels have been written by women, and yet look how men sneer at the lady novelist still. There's only one way for a woman to get on, and that is to please men.
Mm.
That is what they think we are for.
Yes.
We men are beasts. Beasts.
Yes. We are the species. Men are only incidents. To begin with, women were the rulers. They owned all the property. They invented all the arts. The lords of creation just ran about and did what they were told.
But is that really so?
It has been proved by American professors.
But how did they prove it?
By science. And now look at us, Ann Veronica. See what we have become. Delicate trifles. We have become parasites and toys.
It isn't quite that we're toys. Nobody toys with me. Nobody regards Constance or me as a delicate trifle.
The point is, we're not toys. Toys isn't the word. We're litter.
Mm.
We're handfuls. We're inflammable litter that mustn't be left lying around.
Quite.
The practical trouble is our age. They used to hurry up and marry us off at 17 and rush us into things. We're partly human beings and partly females in suspense.
Yeah, that's it. They have no plans for us, no idea what to do with us.
There is no remedy, girls, except the vote. Give us that. Oh, I wish I could make every woman, every girl, see this as clearly as I see it. Just what the vote means to us.
Yes.
As Ann Veronica went back along the avenue, Teddy overtook her.
I say, V, half a minute. It's like this. You want freedom. Look here. You know, if you want freedom, just an idea of mine, you know how those Russian students do? In Russia, just a formal marriage. Mere formality. Liberates the girl from parental control, see? You marry me. Simply. No further responsibility whatsoever. Without hindrance. Why not? Quite willing. Get a license. Just an idea of mine. Doesn't matter a bit to me. Do anything to please you, V. Anything. Not fit to be dust on your boots, still. There you are.
Oh, it's awfully good of you, Teddy. But I don't see just how it fits in the present situation.
No? Well, I just suggested it. Threw it out. Of course, if at any time see reason, alter your opinion. Always at your service. No offence, I hope. All right. I'm off. Due to play hockey. Jackson's horrid snorters. So long, V. Just suggested it, see? Nothing really. Passing thought.
Teddy, you are a dear.
Oh, quite.
He lifted an imaginary hat and left her. That afternoon, Ann Veronica was at Lady Palsworthy's garden party. Lady Palsworthy was the social leader of Morningside Park, and in her superficial way, an extremely kind and pleasant woman. She understood the art of bringing people together, and they never talked of anything at all, never discussed, never even encouraged gossip. They were just nice. Across the lawn and hovering indecisively, Ann Veronica spotted Lady Palsworthy's nephew.
Oh, golly, no. Not Mr. Manning.
Mr. Manning had shown on previous occasions that he found Ann Veronica interesting. He was a tall young man of 37, with a handsome, thoughtful face and a full black moustache.
You are looking splendid today, Miss Stanley. How well and jolly you must be feeling. I love this warm end of summer more than words can tell. I've tried to make words tell it in a poem, It's no good. You want music.
Yes.
Oh, splendid to be a composer. Glorious. The Pastoral Symphony Beethoven. He's the best of them, don't you think? Tum-tum-tum, today, tum-tum.
Yes.
And what have you been doing since our last talk? Still cutting up rabbits and probing into things? I have often thought of those talks of ours.
Beautiful, aren't they, these autumn flowers?
Oh, do come and see the Michaelmas daisies at the end of the garden. Oh, they're a dream.
And Anne Veronica involuntarily found herself in a remote spot of the garden.
Yes, the Michaelmas daisies are very good this year.
Oh, I either want to shout when I see beautiful things, or else I want to weep, or else I want to pray.
And when is Michaelmas Day?
Oh, heaven knows, 29th?
I thought it was earlier. Wasn't Parliament due to reassemble then?
You're not interested in politics.
Oh, yes. I'm very interested.
I find my interest in that sort of thing decline and decline.
I'm curious. Perhaps because I don't know much. I suppose an intelligent person ought to be interested in political affairs. They concern us all.
Do they? Well, I wonder.
I think they do.
Well, I don't think they're doing so this afternoon, and I don't think you do. I'm old-fashioned, Miss Stanley. I don't think women need to trouble about political questions.
I want to vote.
Really? Oh, I wish you didn't.
Why not?
Well, it seems to me a woman's job is to be beautiful and to behave beautifully, and politics are, by their very nature, are ugly. I am a woman worshipper. We can't afford to turn our goddesses and fairy princesses into a sort of man. My politics wouldn't be to give women votes. I'm a socialist, Miss Stanley.
What?
I would make this country a collective monarchy, and all the girls and women in it would be the queen. And we, the men, would work for them and serve them in loyal fealty.
That's rather the theory now. Only so many men neglect their duties. So far as one can judge from the system and practice, it doesn't work.
Women have far more power than they think, as inspirations. Oh, you say you want to vote?
I think I ought to have one.
Well, I have two. One in Oxford University and one in Kensington. Let me present you with them and be your voter.
I want a vote for myself. I don't see why I should take it second hand. Have you ever voted, Mr. Manning? I suppose there's a sort of place like a ticket office in a ballot box. What is a ballot box like, exactly?
Well, a ballot box is very largely just a box.
2 days later came the day of the crisis, the day of the Fadden dance. It would have been a crisis anyway, but it was complicated in Anne Veronica's mind by the fact that a letter from Mr. Manning had arrived on the very same day.
My dear Miss Stanley, I hope you will forgive me for bothering you with a letter. But I feel there are things I want to say to you so much that I cannot wait until we meet again. Things I had meant to say to you that afternoon at Lady Palsworthy's that were coursing through my head, but instead I said nothing. I come to you now, a pure and unencumbered man, to say I love you.
Oh, my goodness, I can't read this here.
With a well-simulated unconcern and a heightened colour, she finished her breakfast and strolled into the vegetable garden, and hidden from the windows of the house, she settled down in a disused greenhouse to read her letter.
Before I met you, I never met anyone whom I felt I could love.
And you have discovered depths in my own nature I had scarcely suspected. Well, except for a few early ebullitions of passion, natural to a warm and romantic disposition, and leaving no harmful after-effects. Ebullitions that, by the standards of the higher truth, I feel no one can justly cast a stone at, and of which I, for one, am by no means ashamed. I come to you a pure and unencumbered man. My mind is full of images and ideas that I have been cherishing, of seeing you dressed like a queen and shining in some brilliant throng, or looking at flowers in some old world garden, our garden. I am a resolute man, and hitherto, when I have wanted something, I have got it. But I have never wanted anything as much as I want you. I have said what I had to say, stumblingly and badly, but I am sick of tearing up letters and hopeless at getting what I want. Let me put the main question to you now that I could not put the other afternoon. Will you marry me, Anne Veronica? Very sincerely yours, Hubert Manning.
How odd. I suppose I shall have to write an answer.
Veronica!
I'm going for a walk, Auntie.
Alone, dear?
Yes. I've got a lot to think about.
I wonder.
A little breathlessly, Aunt Molly went into Ann Veronica's room.
Let me see.
She went straight over to the wardrobe, and there, hanging among the more normal clothing, was a skimpy dress of red canvas so short it could hardly reach the knee. On the same peg was a black velvet jacket, but the third item she took hold of caused her hand to tremble violently and fell into two baggy crimson masses.
Trousers!
Ann Veronica had three things very definitely settled by the time she found herself perched up on a gate between a bridle path and a field that commanded the whole wide stretch of country between Chalking and Waldersham.
Firstly, I do not intend to marry at all, and particularly not Mr. Manning. Secondly, I mean to go on with my studies, and not at the Treadgold schools, but at the Imperial College. And thirdly, I will go to the Fadden Ball tonight. I will go. What will Father do? Turn me out of doors? So be it. I will go. Mr. Ramage?
Oh, Miss Stanley. Oh, you've got my view. I always get off here and lean over that rail for a bit. May I do so today?
It's your gate. You got it first. It's for you to say if I may sit on it.
Let me introduce you to Caesar.
And she patted Caesar's neck and remarked how soft his nose was and secretly deplored the ugliness of equine teeth.
And what are you doing here, young lady, wandering alone so far from home?
I like long walks.
Solitary walks?
That's the point of them. I think over all sorts of things.
Problems?
Sometimes quite difficult problems.
You're lucky to live in an age when you can do so. Your mother, for instance, couldn't. She had to do her thinking at home, under inspection.
I suppose things have changed.
I must confess, the new woman and the new girl intrigued me profoundly. And the change of attitude. If you had lived 20 years ago, you would have been called a young person, and it would have been your chief duty in life not to know, never to have heard of, or never to understand.
There's quite enough still that one doesn't understand.
Quite. But your role would have been to go about saying, I beg your pardon, in a reproving tone, to things you understood quite well in your heart and saw no harm in. I had rather gossip to a really intelligent girl than to any man alive. I wonder that more girls don't think as you do and want to strike out in the world. Let me say one thing. If ever you do, and I can help you in any way, by advice or inquiry or recommendation. You see, I'm no believer in feminine incapacity, but I do perceive there is such a thing as feminine inexperience. I can think of nothing more pleasant in life than to help you. Because I know it would pay to help you. See, there's something about you, a little flavour of willpower about you, I suppose, that makes one feel good luck and success will be yours for the taking.
They talked for the better part of an hour.
Right.
And after protestations of friendship that were almost ardent, he mounted a little clumsily.
Shouldn't have moved there. Right.
And rode off, looking his best, making a leg with his riding gaiters, smiling and saluting. When Mr. Stanley came home at 6:15, 15 minutes earlier than usual, his sister greeted him in the hall.
So glad you're here, Peter. She means to go.
Go? Where?
That ball.
What ball?
The question was rhetorical. He knew.
I believe she's dressing upstairs now.
Then tell her to undress. Confound her.
The city had been thoroughly annoying that day, and he was angry from the outset.
I don't think she will.
She must. I'm going to my study. It's ridiculous.
She's going to have some sort of meal with the Widgets down the avenue and go up with them.
She told you that?
Yes.
When?
At tea.
But why didn't you prohibit the whole thing once and for all? How dare she tell you that?
Out of defiance. She just sat and told me that was the arrangement. I've never seen her quite so sure of herself.
What did you say?
I said, my dear Veronica, how can you think of such things?
And then?
She had two more cups of tea and some cake and told me of her walk.
Oh, she'll meet somebody one of these days, walking about like that.
She didn't say she'd met anyone.
But didn't you say anything more about the ball?
I said everything I could say as soon as I realised she was trying to avoid the topic. I said, it is no use your telling me about this walk and pretending you have told me about the ball, because you haven't. Your father has forbidden you to go.
Well?
She said, I hate being horrid to you and father, but I feel it my duty to go to that ball.
Felt it her duty?
Well, very well, then, I said. I wash my hands of the whole business. Your disobedience is upon your own head.
But this is flat rebellion. You ought at once to have told her that. What duty does a girl owe to anyone before her father? Obedience to him. That is the first law.
Oh, shh, Peter, she's coming down.
Tell her to come to my study. I wish to speak to her.
Her aunt had never seen her looking so fine or so pretty. Her fancy dress, save for the green-grey stockings, the pseudo-Turkish slippers, and baggy silk trousers natural to a pirate's bride, was hidden in a large black silk-hooded opera cloak.
I'm just off, aunt.
Your father is in the study and wishes to speak to you.
I'm just in time to say goodbye before I go, father. I'm going up to London with the Widgets to the ball.
Now, look here, Aunt Veronica, you are not going to that ball.
I thought we had discussed that, Father.
You're not going out of the house in that get-up.
I am going. I'm sorry to seem to have disobeyed you, but I am. I wish we needn't have quarrelled.
I don't think you can have heard me, V. I said you were not to go. Now, where are you going? Stop!
Goodbye!
No, 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 you don't!
Yes, I do!
Stop it!
Let go!
Never for a moment had violence come between these two since long ago, when he had, in spite of her mother's protest, carried her kicking and squalling to the nursery for some forgotten crime. With something near to horror, they found themselves thus confronted.
You will not go!
Abruptly, she desisted, recoiled, and turned and fled upstairs. She gained her room and...
Oh, God! I won't stand it! I'll go tonight!
Looking wildly round her room, she went to her window, opened it, and scrambled out onto the leaded space above the bathroom on the first floor.
I haven't done this for 5 years.
But things that a girl of 16 may do in short skirts are not things to be done by a young lady of 21 in fancy dress and an opera cloak. And as she realised the truth of this, she discovered that Mr. Pragmar, who lived 3 gardens away, was standing by his forgotten lawn beside the forgotten lawnmower, watching her intently. She was stuck. She shuffled backwards and found it extremely difficult to infuse an air of quiet correctitude into her return through the window. At 8 that evening, Aunt Molly tapped at Anne Veronica's bedroom door.
I brought you up some dinner, V.
Anne Veronica was lying on her bed in a darkling room, staring at the ceiling. Her aunt did not object to capital punishment, or war, or the industrial system, or casual wards, or flogging of criminals, or the massacres in the Congo Free State, because none of these things really got hold of her imagination. But she did object. She did not like. She could not bear to think of people not having and enjoying their meals. As soon as dinner was over that night, she went into the kitchen and compiled a specially prepared, nice tray.
Bee.
And Veronica was frightfully hungry. She found herself in the presence of the most disconcerting fact in human experience. The kindliness of people you believe to be wrong. She took the tray with both hands, gulped, and gave way to tears. Her aunt leapt unhappily to thoughts of penitence.
Oh, my dear. I do so wish you would realise how it grieves your father.
I don't think you see how it shames and disgraces me.
I hope I will find you in a better, a more obedient state of mind tomorrow. Good night, V. And think, dear, he is your father.
There's no reason. I will keep fighting. By God, I will,
said Ann Veronica, for the first time in her life. Ann Veronica had an impression that she did not sleep at all that night. And at any rate, she got through an immense amount of feverish feeling and thinking.
What am I going to do? I must get away from home. I must go.
To remain, she felt, would be to concede everything.
I will have to go tomorrow. If I delay...
If she delayed a day...
I would delay 2 days.
If she delayed 2 days...
I would delay a week.
And after a week...
Submission forever. No, I'll die. I'll die if I stay.
She made plans and estimated means and resources. These and her general preparations had perhaps a certain disproportion.
There's my gold watch. A very good gold watch. It was Mother's. And a pearl necklace. Some pretty rings, silver bangles, and a few trinkets. There's £3.13 of my dress and book allowance still unspent. And I have a few good saleable books. With all that, I should be able to set up a separate establishment for myself in the world. And then I will find work. I'm not sure how, but I will.
She fought the gaps of disconcerting doubt when the universe was making sinister and threatening faces at her, defying her to defy.
I don't care. I'll fight it. The only difficulties will be getting my luggage out of this house and away from Morningside Park. I'll go. I don't care what happens,
said Ann Veronica for the 100th time.
I know. Of course. I'll ask Teddy Widget or Constance to help me with my luggage.
The next day, she found the young Widgets engaged in languid reminiscences of the Fadden Ball.
Oh, we're all a bit decayed, V.
And where were you last night, V? We missed you.
I was locked in. Because Father and Aunt Molly thought my Turkish trousers were too shocking to be seen by respectable people.
Oh, my God.
What are you going to do?
What can one do? Would you stand it? I'm going to clear out.
Clear out?
Go to London.
But how can you? Who will you stop with?
I shall go on my own. Take a room.
I say. But who's going to pay for the room?
I've got money. Anything is better than this. This stifled life down here.
And seeing that Constance was obviously developing objections, she plunged at once into a demand for help.
I've got nothing in the world to pack with except a toy-sized portmanteau. Can you lend me some stuff?
You are a chap.
They did what they could for her. They agreed to lend her their hold-all and a large formless bag they called the communal trunk.
I am ready to go to the ends of the earth for you, V, and carry your luggage all the way.
Thank you, Teddy.
Constance, looking out of the window, saw Ann Veronica's aunt going down to the shops.
You must go on with it. Now's your time, whilst your auntie's out.
I'll take the bags and go round by the garden backs and drop them over the fence.
Take care no one sees you. My aunt will be back from the shops soon. She'll have lunch, and then when she's retired for her digestive hour, I'll pack the bags and bring them to you at the garden gate, and you can take them to the station in time for the 3:17 train to London, and I will meet you there.
Right.
All this was exciting and entertaining. As planned, she carried bag and hold-all to the garden gate, where Teddy, in a state of ecstatic service, bore them to the railway station. Ann Veronica went upstairs again.
Now I must get ready to leave. My home. I didn't think it would be so hard. I must dress carefully for town.
The skirt. Coat. This is a business-like looking hat.
And once changed, she left her room, she left her home, and with a wave of emotion she could not control, she walked down the avenue to catch the 3:17 train to London.
Thanks for everything, Teddy!
If you want anything or get into any trouble, wire me. I'd do anything, V. It's horrible to think of...
You're a tremendous brick, Teddy!
Who wouldn't be for you? You're splendid! Good luck! Good luck!
Bye-bye, Teddy! Bye-bye!
She waved from the window until the bend hid him. Alone in the train, she felt smaller and more adventurous even than she'd expected to feel.
Let me see. I'm going to take a room in a lodging house, because it will be cheaper in the long run. But perhaps I'd better book a room in a hotel tonight. But if I told a cabman to take me to a hotel, he might drive me somewhere dreadfully expensive. I'll book my luggage in at Waterloo and look around for myself.
Ann Veronica left the train, booked her luggage into the cloakroom, and walked out into London with a peculiar exaltation of mind, an exaltation that partook of panic and defiance, but was chiefly a sense of vast, unexampled release. She inhaled a deep breath of air, London air. It seemed at first the most beautiful afternoon of all time to her, with no great throng of people, the river, Westminster and St. Paul's were rich with the soft sunshine. And in this great mellow place, this London was now hers.
Oh, I'm glad I came.
She marked a hotel that seemed neither opulent nor odd in a little side street opening on the embankment and then returned with her luggage.
Do you have a single room available, please?
She found herself presently in room number 47.
All right, so far.
She sat in the corner of the small, stark room and suddenly felt miserably alone, bereft and blank, as though she didn't matter, she and her gear.
I think I'll go out again, get something to eat in the aerated bread shop and perhaps find a cheap room for myself, something a bit more homely.
She walked along the Strand and across Trafalgar Square to Oxford Street. She hesitated outside the Army and Navy stores. Should she go in and ask for a job? But was distracted by a man about her father's age who had a flushed face, sneaky eyes and a hungry gaze staring at her.
Whither away, my pretty?
Amazed, Ann Veronica stepped aside and quickened her step.
Strange old man.
Across the street, she noticed the man again. Beyond Oxford Circus, Ann Veronica went into a British Tea Table Company shop to get some tea. As she was waiting for her tea to come, she saw the man yet again. He came down the shop, quite obviously looking for her, and took up a position on the other side against a mirror. He was following her.
I'll ignore him. Surely I can ignore him.
The art of ignoring is installed so well into young women, they can ignore their own thoughts, and yet she was ruffled. In fact, she was furious. He had taken his silk hat off and was gloating upon her, smiling and trying to catch her eye.
That he should be in the same world with me!
As she left the tea shop, the afternoon had passed now into twilight. The street lamps were glowing into existence, and she didn't know what to do. She looked into a flower shop. He passed.
Thank goodness!
He came back, stood beside her, silently looking into her face. She went from street to street. She had lost her way, and all the glory of London had departed. Against the sinister, threatening, monstrous inhumanity of the limitless city, there was nothing now but this ugly fact of a pursuit. The pursuit of the undesired, persistent male. She was on the verge of getting help from a passerby when her follower vanished. He had gone. The night had swallowed him up. She reached Euston Road and there, by the name on a bus, made a guess of her way home. She was afraid of the dark open doorways, of the blazes of light, of being alone. At last she made it back to the hotel. She came very near to returning home, but in spite of a fitful night's sleep, the morning brought courage, and those first intimations of horror vanished completely from her mind. She sent her father a telegram from the East Strand post office, worded thus.
All is well with me and quite safe.
And afterwards she dined a la carte upon a cutlet and had then set herself to write an answer to Mr. Manning's proposal of marriage. But she had found it very difficult.
Dear Mr. Manning, I find it very difficult to answer your letter. I hope you won't mind if I say first that I think it does me an extraordinary honour that you should think of anyone like myself so highly and seriously. And secondly, I wish that it had not been written. You see, I am too young and ignorant for marriage. So please, if you will,
forget you wrote that letter and forgive this answer. I do hope you will be able to do this because I value men friends. I want to be a person by myself and pull my own strings. I had rather have trouble and hardship like that than be taken care of by others. I want to be myself. I do hope you will see how things are and not be offended with me or frightfully shocked and distressed by what I have done. Very sincerely yours, Anne Veronica Stanley.
In the afternoon, she resumed her search for an apartment. One or two landladies refused her with an air of conscious virtue, even outright disapproval, which in her innocence she found puzzling.
We don't let to ladies of your sort.
She drifted towards Titchfield Street, and the apartments there were either scandalously dirty or unaccountably dear, or both. At last, in a street near the Hampstead Road, she hit upon a room that had an exceptional quality of space and order. She brought her luggage in a cab from the hotel. She tipped the hotel porter sixpence and overpaid the cabman 18 pence, and arranged for a supper of tea, a boiled egg, and some tinned peaches.
And now, what is the next step?
She wrote to her father, which was difficult. He would know her address tomorrow.
Dear old Daddy, oh, he'll make a fearful fuss.
The next morning, her aunt arrived at about 10:30, in black and with an unusually thick spotted veil. She raised this with the air of a conspirator unmasking and displayed a tear-stained face.
My dear, you must come home at once. This has almost killed your father.
I sent a telegram.
He cares so much for you.
I sent a telegram and a letter to say I was all right.
All right? Oh, Veronica, to leave your home. Why did you do it? Why could you not confide in us?
Do what?
What you have done.
But what have I done?
Eloped.
Eloped?
We had no idea. We had such pride in you, such hope in you. Your father sat up all night until at last I persuaded him to go to bed. He wanted to put his overcoat on and come after you and look for you in London.
I sent a telegram, Aunt.
Like a stab. You didn't even put the 12 words.
I said I was all right.
Before that came, your father didn't even know you were gone. He was just getting cross at your being late for dinner, you know his way, when it came. He opened it, just offhand, and when he saw what it was, he hit out at the table and sent his soup spoon flying and splashing onto the tablecloth. My God, he said, I'll go after them and kill him.
But what did Father imagine?
That you had eloped. He said, read that, and he threw the telegram at me. It went into the tureen. He swore when I tried to get it out with the ladle. Never since I was a little girl have I seen your father so moved. Oh, little V, he cried, little V.
Do you mean, Aunt, that my father thought I had gone off with some man?
What else could he think? Would anyone dream you'd be so mad as to go off alone?
Well, after what happened the night before?
If you could see him this morning, his poor face as white as a sheet and all cut about with shaving, you must come home to him at once.
I don't think I can do that.
But, my dear, how will you live? Think of what people will say. Oh, think of what Lady Polesworthy will say. Don't you care what Mr. Manning thinks?
I don't care what anyone thinks.
I can't imagine what has come over you, you foolish girl. Don't you care for Mr. Manning?
I don't see what Mr. Manning has to do with my coming to London.
He worships the ground you tread on. You don't deserve it, but he does. And just because your father wouldn't let you disobey him, you can explain your behaviour to him, yourself, this afternoon.
Oh, no.
And sure enough, that afternoon...
A nice time of anxiety you've given me, young lady. I hope you're satisfied. Well, you've had your little adventure, and I hope now you've had enough of it.
I hope I have not distressed you by the course that I felt obliged to take. But you did put me in an impossible position.
Nonsense. Nonsense. Any father in my place would have done as I did. So, go and get your things together while I go and look for a hansom.
I'm not coming home.
Not coming home?
No.
Do you understand what you are doing? If you do not obey me, you will never darken my doors again. You will never touch a single penny of my money, not one penny.
I don't care.
You
Poor child, don't you see the infinite folly of these proceedings? Think of the love and affection you're abandoning. Think of your aunt, a second mother to you. Think if your own mother were alive.
If my own mother was alive, she would understand.
Let us have no more of this humbug. You are to come home. Do you understand?
Yes, I understand. I understand. Not a penny, not one penny, and never darken your door again.
Oh.
Ye gods, I've done it this time.
And now, for some weeks, Ann Veronica was to test her market value in the world. She went about in that dark, foggy November London to find that modest but independent employment she had so rashly assumed would be hers for the asking.
I don't have much experience. Well, none. And there is so little work for women, but...
A secretarial post arose in which there was no specific exclusion of womanhood, with a Harley Street doctor.
I'm afraid a secretary of mine would be required to process a large amount of detailed information.
Yes, and
the less appealing facets of the human condition may not be suitable for the eyes of such a young, inexperienced lady.
But I...
Sorry. Goodbye.
I might find work as a governess or teaching assistant. Or I could go into a business. A photographer's receptionist or a costumier's or... A hat shop.
You're far too young and not at all suitable for the post.
Is filled.
What am I going to do? I must find a job. Mr. Ramage is here. Somewhere in the city. Find out his address. Swallow my pride. And ask him to help me. And find me a job.
Oh, but this is a surprise. This is wonderful. I've been feeling that you've vanished from my world. Have you been away from Morningside Park?
I'm not interrupting you.
You are.
Splendidly.
Business exists for such interruptions. There you are. The best client's chair. I've been looking out for you, I must confess.
I want some advice. Do you remember how we talked on the Downs about how a girl can get an independent living?
Yes.
Well, you see... Something has happened at home.
Nothing has happened to Mr. Stanley.
I've fallen out with my father. It was about a question of what I might do or not do. In fact, he locked me in the house.
Oh, I say.
So I packed up and came to London next day.
To a friend?
To lodgings, alone.
I say, you know, you have some pluck. Well, you did it on your own?
Quite on my own.
That's magnificent. By Jove, there is something direct about you. Now, how has the world taken it? Well, if I was the world, I would have put down a crimson carpet and asked you to say what you wanted, and generally let you walk all over me. But the world didn't do that?
Not exactly.
It presented a large, impenetrable back and went on thinking about something else.
It offered from 15 to 22 shillings a week for drudgery.
Ugh, the world has no sense of what is due to youth and courage.
Yes, but the thing is, I want a job.
Exactly. What ought you to do?
I've hunted up all sorts of things.
Well, the point to note is that fundamentally you don't particularly want to do it.
I don't understand.
Well, you want to be free and so forth. But you don't want to do the job that sets you free for its own sake. I mean, it doesn't interest you in itself.
I suppose not.
And that's one of our differences. We men are like children. We can get absorbed in play, in games, in the businesses we do, and that's why we do them, sometimes rather well. But women, as a rule, don't throw themselves into things like that. And that's what makes a clever woman's independent career so much more difficult than a man's.
I don't know.
The central thing in her life is life itself. The warmth of life, sex, and love.
It isn't quite what I had in mind.
Well, of course not. Well, you see, from my point of view, you are grown up. You're as old as all the goddesses and the contemporary of any alive. But from the economic point of view, you're a child. Now, look here. If you must be free, why not do the sensible thing? Make yourself worth a decent freedom. Go on with your studies at the Imperial College, for example. Get a degree and make yourself good value.
But I can't do that. How am I to live?
Easily. Easily. Borrow from me.
I couldn't do that.
Well, I see no reason why you shouldn't. Men are always doing it.
No, it's absolutely out of the question, Mr. Ramage.
But before Christmas, with an awakening sense of her need for money, Ann Veronica had gone to Ramage again and accepted his offer as a loan.
£40? Yes, it's best to make it a good round sum. Well, it's jolly to feel that you've come to me. Last time you made me feel snubbed. Oh, it's just upon my lunchtime. Come and have lunch with me.
Ann Veronica, for some indefinable reason, did not want to lunch with him. A reason indeed so indefinable that she dismissed it. And the next minute saw her whisked in a hansom to Soho.
There we are. Here we go, my dear. Ritter's, Dean Street.
Ann Veronica was Amy Hoggett. The narrator, H.G. Wells, was Bill Nighy. Mr. Stanley, Geoffrey Whitehead. Mr. Ramage, Jonathan Keeble. And Aunt Molly was Ruth Alexander Rubin. Teddy was Ashley Margolis. Constance, Emily Piton. Miss Miniver, Victoria Brazier. And Mr. Manning was Toby Haydock. Ann Veronica by H.G. Wells was dramatised by Ellen Dryden and directed in Salford by Pauline Harris.